Mathematics, the Master Science 261. As already intimated, every compound body is composed of the qualities of the monad and the duad. Aristotle reminds the disciple that a number, such as the six for example, partakes of the nature of the duad in that it is composed of parts, i.e., six monads. But it also partakes of the monad itself in that these parts form a whole, the six, and the question naturally arises. By what virtue do a number of monads group together to form a definite wholeness to which an arbitrary term is given? In other words, why do six monads make six rather than simply six monads, for the six is not denominated six L's but a unity composed of six. As the Pythagoreans explain it, the six monads may be considered as six pieces of wood from which is fashioned a chair, which we will call the number six itself. By what virtue do these six separate objects form a new and definite pattern? And why should they not always remain simply a bundle of wood? If the numbers were merely aggregations of monads, they would all be bundles, differing simply in the number of their parts. By virtue of a divine order, however, these parts are made to pattern themselves into new terms. The Platonists declared that as a carpenter fashioned a new object out of the separate elements, so a mysterious agent called the Numkratovk, soul being itself a monad and consequently a wholeness composed of infinite diversity, gives form and subsistence to all numbers according to definite divine laws. But, Thomas Taylor concludes, in this only consists the difference, that the carpenter's art is not naturally inherent in us, and requires manual operation, because it is conversant with sensible matter. But the numerative art is naturally present with us, and is there for possessed by all men, and has an intellectual matter which it instantaneously invests with form. In the light of Pythagoreanism, it is no cause for amaze. Meant that six monads are never without the innate sense of sixness, for the moment a certain number of units are combined, they are ensouled by the quality equal to their sum, and invested with an organized formative nature through which they manifest a wholeness where previously they manifested a separateness. It follows that with the establishment of sums, these sums are automatically invested by the rational soul of man himself with the sense of wholeness equal to their number. If three, for example, be taken from six, that which remains is immediately invested with the wholeness of three. We must give form to numeration, for our soul cannot endure to see that which is formless, unadorned, especially as she possesses the power of investing it with ornament. The soul naturally desires the adornment of wholeness, and recognizing this intrinsic urge is pleased to confer it upon other natures. Forms are consequently the sense of wholeness superimposed upon parts by the rational soul, to the end that these forms are no longer regarded as bundles of monads but as definite structures. To summarize, the world is an infinite number of monads, grouped into an infinite diversity of patterns, each pattern invested in a quality called form, which quality is measured by the quantity of the monadic parts. The world is adorned with numbers which hang upon it as ornaments upon the person. Each group of numbers is capable of infinite division, but whether in its divided or undivided state, it in turn is adorned with an infinite diversity of unities or wholes which issue forth in response to the urge of the rational soul to clothe abstractions in denominating natures. Thus the law which governs the increase and decrease of wholes, and the superimposition of wholeness upon number, is a manifestation of a divine urge within the numerative monad, which is termed number and is a definite attribute of cause itself. In this manner we see mathematically demonstrated how man, the unconditioned principle, is obscured by men, the in finite diversity, how mind, the yellow emperor, is hidden in the midst of minds which think in many terms and with many results, but which reason all toward the same end. We behold the Creator so veiled by his creations that his own dignity is no longer apparent but is absorbed into the effulgence of his spheres. As we gaze forth upon the universal vista, we see the veils behind which stand the divine principles, the immovable causes of motion, the ungenerated causes of generation, the undying causes of life and death. Our external parts reach forth. 262 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Mathematics, the Master Science. 263. To grasp the external substance of the All, our tiny fingers reach out to pluck the stars from their thrones, and our outer being bows with veneration before the outer substances that are its very self and from which it was mined in the primordial day. Meanwhile, our inner selves, the invisible cause of our visible activity, yearn to be mingled with the spirit of cosmos. The golden thread thepernd ua lioth thlo. The diagram represents the casual universe. The thread of manifestation is seen unwinding from the archetypal germ to descend asinara unfantin into theglobeofthesoul fromthenceitfllittertialsertite. RADIANTSOLARCENTER. Chapter 12. Demigods and Supermen. W. Hence Socrates declared irony and inductive reasoning to be the peculiar instruments of philosophy, he implied far more than the words convey to the average layman. As previously stated, pages 189, the soul of man when immersed in generation manifests according to the laws of the generating sphere. Hence man can only liberate himself from corporeal conditions by first freeing his rational part from mundane entanglements. The personality with its numerous attributes is suspended from the generating soul, and consequently the clarification of consciousness is attainable only by the liberation of the self from the generating principle. While invested with the substances of the generating sphere, the rational soul is capable of objectifying an infinite diversity of forms or bodies. These the generating soul spontaneously evolves from its own nature by virtue of its inherent formative qualities. As forms and corporeal natures continuously flow from the soul thus invested with generating attributes, it is evident that any attempt to escape diversity by dispersion of the forms is futile. The generating soul is like the fabled dragon: for every head that is cut off, two more grow to take its place. Inhibitions and aus territories are efforts to combat the processes of the generating soul by destruction of the generations as they come forth. But the task is never finished, and no permanent victory is ever won. The remodeling of character through the despotism of will is, therefore, at best, an imperfect and inadequate procedure. 2. Arbitrarily remove the ends, while the means which produce those ends are permitted to remain, is to imperil the entire nature in which such inconsistency exists. 265. In a certain sense, man is an appendage of impulse, hence the regeneration of character must be through the reformation of impulses and not their inhibition. A certain consistency must exist upon all planes of activity. The animal soul must ever express itself through animal instincts, the generating soul through the instincts of generation, and the rational soul through the urge to rationality. For the internal nature thus to function upon one level of consciousness while the external nature attempts to exist upon another, is to create a confusion which must inevitably result in disaster. Socrates maintained that the rationalizing of the individual must take place in the causal nature which, flowing downward into the corporeal constitution, will speedily mold the inferior into the image of the superior. Hence his emphasis upon the efficacy of irony and inductive reasoning. Irony is here to be understood in the sense of fate, which philosophers have ever declared to be ironical. Fate affects the liberation of the rational part by revealing that all things are destined to return to their own natures, or origins, in spite of every effort to nullify this design. Ultimate achievement is hence unavoidable, and is the certain end of all beginnings, but incalculable is the interval that must elapse before the operations of divine procedure restore all things to their primal state. Irony, therefore, is the long way around the path of the drone. It is beset with every obstacle that materiality can contrive, it leads through death and sorrow, and he who chooses to take the bufferings of destiny must be prepared to withstand the blasts of outrageous circumstance. Ironically, he who chooses to do the least must accomplish the most, for none shall labor as hard as the sluggard or struggle as intensely for liberation as the one content to drift upon the sea of providence. Whoever chooses to escape the responsibilities of life exhausts himself in his efforts to dodge inevitables. For the foolish, then, the ironic road; for the wise, the true Socratic path, the theory of inductive reasoning, establishing his entire philosophy upon man, consequently upon a particular Socrates reasoned therefrom to generals, thus establish 266 lectures on ancient philosophy, a procedure to which Francis Bacon added the essential element of analogy. Induction infers a process of thought, whereby the rationality which is posited in particulars is urged or impelled to retire along the line of its own flow, and verge toward the monad, or general, of which it is the particular. In other words, Socrates sought to arrive at divine realities by causing particulars to retire into their own general state. While the monad might erroneously be considered a particular, it is in reality a general, and the manifestations which emerge from it are the particulars.